We are glad to present your speaker, Don Blackwell.
This week marks the 200th anniversary of the birth of Charles Darwin. And because of that, some people in the world are celebrating. In fact, the University of South Carolina is having what they call Darwin Day this week. And they are celebrating the one that they believe finally answered the question for us, where did we come from? But as we think about the attacks made on Christianity, and we think about the things the atheists and the evolutionists are saying and putting forth, New Testament Christians need to be prepared to answer the charges of atheism. And so what we want to do today is to ask the question, was Darwin wrong? Was Darwin wrong about the things that he had to say? And really, this is a question of great significance, because what we're really asking is, does God exist? Because if Darwin is right, then we're wasting our time this morning. In fact, we're really a laughingstock in the things that we're engaged in today. And the answer to this question really affects all other questions. Now, I want to begin by giving you a little bit of background on Charles Darwin. Charles Darwin was born as Charles Robert Darwin on February the 12th, 1809. Darwin's mother died when he was 8 years old, and so her influence was very little upon his life. His father was a successful doctor running one of the largest medical practices outside of London. His father was named Erasmus Darwin, and his grandfather was Erasmus Darwin, and he was the author of the book Zoonomia, also known as The Laws of Organic Life. Now, you can guess these two men had a tremendous influence on the worldview of Darwin and the man that he would eventually become. At the early age of 16, Darwin was sent to the University of Edinburgh to study medicine, but he couldn't make it as a doctor. And so 2 years later, his father sent him to Cambridge, where he studied, of all things, divinity. As a matter of fact, the only degree that Darwin had was a divinity degree. Now, of course, what Charles Darwin is known for is his evolutionary model. According to his evolution model, the universe is completely self-contained. That is to say, the universe is all that exists. There is no first cause. There is no superintending intelligence, no divine guidance that's responsible for the world we see around us. Rather, he says the universe and its complex systems, including all non-human organisms and man, etc., can be explained on the basis of random, chance, naturally occurring processes that have taken place over eons of time. In other words, there's no God. It just happened by chance. Of course, what he is best known for is his book called The Origin of Species. This book was written in 1859. The full title is The Origin of Species by Means of Natural Selection or the Preservation of Favored Races in the Struggle for Life. Now, this book sets forth the idea that everything that exists, all living organisms, came from a common ancestor. We have a common evolutionary tree of life. Now, what effect has this had over the last 150 years? The effect that it has had is that for many, evolution has become a religion to them. It is what they practice. It is what they worship. It is the modern-day Baal of the intellectually elite. And today, many believe that those who do what we're doing today, worship the God of heaven, are ignorant and backwards, and they attack them on every turn. But what is so sad is that many Christians have bought into this lie. Now, why is this? Why are there Christians who have lost their faith and instead have begun to believe that we are the product of mere chance? I'll tell you why. It's largely because that's what they have been taught since they were little children. They have been inundated with it constantly. Now, what exactly are we teaching our children to make them believe this? I want you to notice some of the ways that children are inundated with evolution. This is a Wendy's Kids Meal, teaching the fact that birds are related to dinosaurs. There is an Arby's Kids Meal doing a similar thing. Magic School Bus. If you've got kids, you know about Magic School Bus. Time Magazine constantly saying things like this. The X-Men comic books dealing with evolution. It's something that they see all the time, everywhere. Our children are inundated with this. Here is a Prentice Hall biology book, page 757, a quote from it. It says, "We know, for example, that humans evolved from common ancestors that we share with other living primates, such as chimpanzees and apes. We and the monkeys came from the same source." Page 352 says, "Like all other forms of life, humans are products of evolution by natural selection. Now, I want you to notice several of these textbook covers here. These begin with the first book, grade book. Most of these are by Merrill. Some are by Prentice Hall. We're going to focus in on several of these. The first one is the first one from the list. This is a first grade textbook from Merrill Science, 1989. Inside of that book, they're being taught in the first grade, Earth has changed much since its formation 4.5 billion years ago. You move on in the textbook studies to second grade. We read, since its formation 4.5 billion years ago, Earth has changed. So we could go through a lot of these for the sake of time. We're not going to do that. Here's another, though. Prentice Hall General Science book. It says, most astronomers believe that about 18 to 20 billion years ago, all matter in the universe was concentrated in one very dense, very hot region that may have been much smaller than a period on this page. For some unknown reason, this region exploded. This explosion is called the Big Bang. Now, that's what they're being taught. We could give multitudes of examples of this. For the sake of time, we will not. But let's ask the question, why does it matter? Why does it matter that our kids are being taught this sort of thing? Does it even matter? Ladies and gentlemen, it matters because many of our children are being intimidated. They don't know how to answer it. They are being taught that evolution is a fact. And they are being bullied into believing that all intellectual people believe in evolution and only a moron would believe in creation. And they're being told that by people they trust. And they're being told that on a regular basis, 5 days a week, sitting in the school system. They're told evolution is a fact like apples falling off of trees. They are being told that evolution is a fact like digestion. They are being taught that evolution is a fact of science, not a theory, although it's a theory. That's what they're being taught. Richard Goldsmith said this, evolution of the animal and plant world is considered by all those, listen to this, all those entitled to a judgment to be a fact for which no further proof is needed. Now, what is the effect of this? The effect of this is the intimidation has caused some of our children to doubt. And they have looked at the truths that they have been taught since they were children, growing up in the Lord's church, and they begin to wonder if indeed that is the case. Now here's a quote that I shared with you on Wednesday night from Richard Dawkins, talking about creationists. He says, it is absolutely safe to say that if you meet someone who claims not to believe in evolution, that person is ignorant, stupid, or insane, or wicked, but I'd rather not consider that. I want you to think about that. Imagine going to college, and here's your college professor, a man with a PhD who holds your future in his hands. He's going to be the one to write you a reference letter to move on. He's got your grade, and he is telling you, this is nonsense what you're talking about, religion and God, and I've got education, and I can prove it. Now, is it the case that all the intellectually elite believe that evolution is a fact of science? I want you to listen to this. It's an old quote, but we're going to get to some more modern ones. This is from Robert A. Millikan. He was a Nobel laureate in physics. He said, the pathetic thing is that we have scientists who are trying to prove evolution, which no scientist can ever prove. Here's another. Scientists who go about teaching that evolution is a fact of life are great con men. And the story they are telling may be the greatest hoax ever. In explaining evolution, we do not have one iota of fact. It is a tangled mishmash of guessing games and figure jaggling. He says, we don't know it. Now, this is a respected scientist. Here's another very interesting quote from Paul Davies and Adam Phillips. Some scientists say, just throw energy at it and it will happen spontaneously. This is a little bit like saying, put a stick of dynamite under a pile of bricks and bang, you've got a house. Of course, you won't have a house. You'll just have a mess. And that's right. I really like this quote. This is from Dr. Etheridge, senior paleontologist of the British Museum. He says, 9/10 of the talk of evolutionists is sheer nonsense, not founded on observation and wholly unsupported by the facts. This museum, the British Museum of Natural History, he says, is full of proofs of the utter falsity of their views. In all this great museum, there is not a particle of evidence of the transmutation of species. Very educated man. I had to put this in because I like this quote. So heated is the debate that one Darwinian says there are times when he thinks about going into a field with more intellectual honesty like being a used car salesman. Well, that's about the truth of it. We want to ask the question this morning, was Darwin wrong? Was he wrong about his theory? In 2004, National Geographic did an issue in which the front page of the magazine asked, "Is Darwin wrong?" And when you open the magazine and you turn to the article, the author exclaims in huge font, "No! The evidence for evolution is overwhelming," it says. And so I want us to look at the evidence they put forth in this article that they say proves that Darwin was right. Now, inside this article, they say that this is a theory that you can take to the bank. They go on to say that the supporting evidence is abundant, it is various, ever-increasing, solidly connected, and easily available in museums, popular textbooks, a mountainous accumulation of peer-reviewed scientific studies. They say no one needs to, nor should anyone, accept evolution merely as a matter of faith. But they said the evidence is there. Now, what is their evidence? The first point they give, the first evidence they state as proof of evolution, is horse evolution. Now, you may have seen a chart like this one on the slide. The creature's name here is Hyracotherium. Now, many of you have seen this before. It starts with a picture of an animal that looks just a little bit bigger than a dog, supposedly, and it evolves itself all the way up to the modern-day horse. Back several decades ago, the American Museum of Natural History assembled a famous exhibit of fossil horses, and it was designed to show the gradual evolution from this creature that is called Hyracotherium all the way up to the modern-day equus, the horse. But the only problem is, it was a fake. It had been created. The evidence really was not there. Herbert Nelson made this statement. He said the family tree of the horse is beautiful and continuous only in the textbooks. In the reality provided by the results of research, it is put together from three parts, of which only the last part can be described as including horses. The forms of the first part are just as much little horses as the present-day daimons are horses. The construction of the horse is therefore a very artificial one, since it is put together from non-equivalent parts and cannot therefore be a continuous transformation series. Now friends, we knew this back in 1954. And yet, in the 2000s, in 2004, we have National Geographic using this as one of the proofs of evolution. In 1954, the evidence was there that this is phony. There is no string of continuous evolution showing the horse going from this animal to this animal. The evidence says they're two different animals. You've got one animal here, and then you've got horses. Stephen Jay Gould put it this way. He said, once ensconced in textbooks, misinformation becomes cocooned and effectively permanent. Now, what's he saying? Once it gets put in one textbook, it gets copied to the next textbook and the next textbook, and it just goes on forever. Gould went on to say, I have written two essays on this lamentable practice, one on the amusingly perennial description of the Eohippus, which is the Hyracotherium, as being the size of a fox terrier. He says, even though most authors, including yours truly, have no idea the dimensions of this breed. He said, I myself have written about this, and I don't know this. Authors write about it, and we don't know this. George Gaylord Simpson said, the uniform continuous transformation of Hyracotherium into equus, the horse, so dear to the hearts of generations of textbook writers, never happened in nature. Jonathan Serfati put it this way. He said, even informed evolutionists regard horse evolution as a bush rather than a sequence, but the so-called Eohippus, that is properly called Hyracotherium, has little that would connect it with horses at all. The other animals in the sequence actually show little variation between them and the horses today. One non-horse and many varieties of a true horse does not a sequence make. Now friends, as I mentioned, we have known this since 1954. And very interestingly, the textbooks today have started to drop the horses from their pages that teach evolutionary theory, and they have actually now started to use camels because they know that the creationists are going to pin them down on this fact and take them to task. Now, I want you to notice this particular one on the slide. I want you to notice who the publisher of this one is. It's National Geographic. And yet, In 2004, National Geographic is using horse evolution as one of the first evidences to prove that Darwin is right. Now, here's the second evidence that they give, and that is embryology. Charles Darwin wrote, "The embryo is the animal in its less modified state, and the state reveals the structure of its progenitor." Now, that's a little confusing. With that in mind, let me show you something that you've probably seen and that clarifies what he's talking about. This is something that was made famous by a man named Ernest Haeckel. You ever seen that before? Sure, you've probably seen that before. Ernest Haeckel is an individual who drew a bunch of embryos. The only problem is he faked them. He forged the picture. Now, if you will look at the screen, you'll see several different creatures, starting out with a fish and a salamander and a turtle, a chicken, a pig, and it goes all the way up to the man. And you'll see them in three different stages of their embryological development. Haeckel's point was this. Early in their development, all of these creatures look the same. And he's basically trying to get across the point that humans go through all of their previous evolutionary steps before they become humans. And so he says we look like a fish and a salamander and a turtle and a chicken and those lower mammals. And finally, we look like humans. Now, this is the actual picture of what it actually looks like. You can see across the top Haeckel's images and across the bottom the actual photos of these embryos. Haeckel faked it. It's a forgery. We've known it for years. Sadly, however, textbooks are still proclaiming humans probably evolved from bacteria that lived more than 4 billion years ago. And yet, we've known about Haeckel's hoax. We've known that he lied. We've known that he forged these pictures for decades, and yet they keep putting it in the textbooks. Stephen Jay Gould, an atheist, in the magazine Natural History, he wrote an article called Atrocious, and he had this to say. He said, "Haeckel remains most famous today as the chief architect and propagandist for a famous argument that science has disproved long ago, but that popular culture has never fully abandoned." He says science long ago recognized this as a forgery and they gave it up, but popular culture won't let it go. They keep putting it in the textbooks. He sums it up this way. "We should therefore not be surprised that Haeckel's drawings entered the 19th century textbooks, But we do, I think, have the right to be both astonished and ashamed by the century of mindless recycling that has led to the persistence of these drawings in a large number, if not the majority, of modern textbooks." He says, long ago, it's not surprising they got into the textbooks, but he says, he uses the term mindless recycling. They just keep putting it in there and putting it in there, even though this man, who is not a creationist, says, "We know it doesn't belong in there." Sir Arthur Keith put it this way. He said, "It was expected that the embryo would recapitulate the features of its ancestors from the lowest to the highest forms in the animal kingdom. Now that the appearance of the embryo at all stages is known, the general feeling is one of disappointment." He says, it's not what Haeckel said. It's not what we expected now that science has shown it to us. "The human embryo at no stage is anthropod in appearance. The embryo of the mammal never resembles the worm, the fish, or the reptile. Embryology provides no support whatsoever for the evolutionary hypothesis." Now, friends, he made that statement in 1932. And yet in 2004, National Geographic uses this as one of their evidences that Darwin is right. That's the best they got? Are you impressed by this? That's the best they've got? Now, sadly, because of the fact that some people have thought Haeckel's image is just too good to pass up, they just keep putting in textbook after textbook. Now, the third piece of evidence that is put forth in National Geographic as a proof is called Archaeopteryx. Now, don't let the spelling of this scare you. It is simply a bird. But to them, it is the bird that is the missing link between dinosaurs and modern-day birds. Now, I showed you this a minute ago. It's a Wendy's kids' meal. Interestingly, across the bottom, it says, I don't know if you can see this from there, but it says, "New findings show that birds are probably related to dinosaurs. Scientists in China have found two fossils of feathered dinosaurs." But you got to love this, because right above it says, in big bold letters, "Fact." And then it says, "New findings show that birds are probably related to dinosaurs." Is it probably or is it a fact? Now, What does Archaeopteryx look like? Here's a picture, if you want to see him, a fossil picture. And here's an artist's rendition of what he supposedly looked like. Well, is this creature the missing link, the transitionary creature from dinosaurs to birds? I want you to listen to what Colin Patterson had to say about this. He said, Archaeopteryx has simply become a patsy for wishful thinking. Is Archaeopteryx the ancestor of all birds? Perhaps yes, perhaps no. There's no way of answering the question. It is easy enough to make up stories of how one form gave rise to another and to find reasons why the stages should be favored by natural selection. But such stories are not a part of science, for there is no way of putting them to the test. Alan Fiducia put it this way. He said, I conclude that Archaeopteryx was arboreal and volant. That is, he possessed extended wings. He had the ability to fly. He says, considerably advanced aerodynamically and probably capable of flapping, powered flight to at least some degree. He concluded by saying this, Archaeopteryx was, in the modern day sense, a bird. He says, it's a bird. I've studied it. I've looked at it. It's a bird. Now, friends, we knew this back in 1993, and yet over a decade later, we are using Archaeopteryx as one of the best evidences for evolution. Now, it begins to make you wonder what this theory really has going for it, doesn't it? This is the best evidence that National Geographic could come up with. Now, National Geographic, a couple of years before this, introduced a creature called Archaeoraptor. It was big headlines. It was supposed to be the missing link between dinosaurs and birds. The only problem was Archaeoraptor was a complete and an utter fraud. What had happened was there were some Chinese farmers who had actually taken two creatures and they put them together. They took the tail of a bird and the body of a dinosaur and they took some fossil mix, some cement paste, and they put these together to form this creature. And they sold it to some researchers. And the researchers bought it, and with a big splash, they said, look, we have got the missing link, and they called it Archaeoraptor. Now, in a sense, you can't blame the Chinese farmer. I mean, he probably makes $100 a year, $200 a year at the most, and he says, I can sell this fossil for thousands of dollars. It's kind of a supply, and that's ethically wrong. I'm not condoning what they did, but National Geographic took it, and they ran with it. They later had to write a retraction of this. They did MRI studies showing that these were two different stones that were put together. But sadly, even though this was proven to be a fake, even though the evidence says that the previous one we looked at was just a bird, they continue to teach that birds are the products of evolution from dinosaurs. Evidence number four that they set forth is natural selection. Changes over millions of years. Now, the first thing I want to point out here is that creationists have no problem with natural selection. God uses natural selection to weed out the weak. And if you want to know the real truth of this, it was a creationist who came up with this idea, a gentleman by the name of Edward Blight. He wrote about this in the years between 1835 and 1837, long before Charles Darwin wrote his book on the origin of species. So we don't have a problem with the idea of the survival of species. But we do have, or the survival of the fittest. But we do have a problem with the idea that some people are arguing that one species is going to change into a different species. You see, natural selection does not provide the mechanism for macroevolution. Now, what do I mean by that? There is a difference in microevolution and macroevolution. Microevolution is true. And it's defined as the small changes within limited parameters that would take place in a species. And we have a lot of this in this country. You know, we breed dogs for various traits. And you've got long-haired dogs and short-haired dogs and large dogs and miniature dogs. But here's the question. We've got dogs of all different traits, but the question is, when you breed two different dogs, what are you going to get? You're still going to get a dog. You can't breed two different dogs and get a palm tree. Or a fern, or a rhinoceros, or a giraffe. You always get a dog. That's microevolution. We know that occurs. Macroevolution, on the other hand, is false. It's never been proven in a lab, and it says that all life descended from a common ancestor. That is, one species can cross over to another species. But the problem is, when biology students are sitting in class, and their teacher teaches them microevolution and says, this is true, we have proven this, and then they slip in and they say, yeah, we can see the way that dogs have changed, and that's the same process by which we came from a common ancestor. It's not. It's not science. A Swedish biologist, Soren Lovtrop, made this comment. He said, micromutations do occur, but the theory that these alone can account for evolutionary change is either falsified or else it is unfalsifiable, hence metaphysical theory. I suppose that nobody will deny that it is a great misfortune, listen to this, if an entire branch of science becomes addicted to a false theory. But this is what has happened in biology. I believe that one day the Darwinian myth will be ranked the greatest deceit in the history of science. When this happens, many people will pose the question, how did this ever happen? He says, it's not what science tells us. And one day we're going to look back and say, how did this happen? How did we believe this? As Hugo de Vries put it, natural selection may explain the survival of the fittest, but it cannot explain the arrival of the fittest. And yet, that was way back in 1905. That this statement was made, that this fact was recognized, and we've known that natural selection cannot explain the arrival of the fittest all of these years, and yet evolutionists are still using this as evidence that Darwin was right. And friends, we have known this is not the case. I hope you're beginning to see just how pathetic the foundation of evolutionary theory really is. Now, one more, and I'm going to stop here. Evidence number 5 presented in this National Geographic article is vestigial structures. Now again, don't let the word scare you. Vestigial structures are supposedly structures that we don't need. They say that we got them from our alleged ancestors and they're just leftovers from the evolutionary process. They're here, we don't need them anymore. Apparently at some point in the past, we did. And they like to talk about the whale. The whale, they will say, has little bones around its pelvis that they say obviously used to be limbs that they used when they were crawling around on the land. That was back before they evolved and went back into the sea. But they're left over and these are limbs that are still there in part. They used to be legs, they say. Now, it is the case, they say they're vestigial. They have no purpose. But they do have a purpose. These bones do have a purpose and National Geographic knows it. Because in the year 2001, they made the statement, today's sperm whale has vestigial, useless, hind limbs. And yet the paragraph right above it makes the statement that the bones do in fact have a purpose. And that is they act as an anchor for the muscles of the genitalia. So do these bones have a purpose? Yes. Are they vestigial? No. Does National Geographic know that? Yes, they do. Now, on the screen, you can see a list of several vestigial organs. I don't know if you can see that from where you are, if it's big enough to read, but it includes things like tonsils, adenoids, the little toe, wisdom teeth, the appendix. In fact, back in 1931, it was supposed that human beings had 180 organs that were considered vestigial or rudimentary. Now, today, we know that is not the case. Today, we know that most of these do have a purpose. R.L. Wysong summed it up this way. He said, not too long ago, man was imputed to have 180 vestiges. Organs like the appendix, tonsils, thymus, pineal, and thyroid glands were on the list. Today, all former vestigial organs are known to have some function during the life of the individual. If the organ has any function at any time, it cannot be called rudimentary or vestigial. As man's knowledge has increased, the list of vestigial organs decreased. And I like this. He says, so what was really vestigial? Was it not man's rudimentary knowledge of the intricacies of the body? I want you to think about this. Just in my lifetime, not many years ago, it was very common that if you went to the doctor, they would remove your tonsils. You get 2 or 3 sore throats, and out come the tonsils. It's not like that anymore. You go to the doctor today, and we have learned that the tonsils have a huge immune function. They help with your immunity, and so doctors are a lot more reluctant to remove your tonsils. Same thing with the appendix. Now, they will remove an appendix if it's enlarged, if it's about to rupture, but they know that it has an immune function, and they won't just arbitrarily remove it. Now, friends, just because something we don't know the function of a particular organ doesn't mean that it is vestigial. It doesn't mean that it's an evolutionary leftover. In fact, it ought to humble us and make us realize that we don't know everything that our Creator knows. Now, ladies and gentlemen, we asked the question, was Darwin wrong? Yes, he was wrong. And you can see when you examine the evidence that it's weak and it's pathetic. But you see, the problem is all too often we don't know. And if we hear enough people say it, and especially if they have a PhD behind their name, we assume it has to be true. But I'm going to share with you a secret. Do you know the real reason that so many people accept evolution? It is not because I'm talking about these doctors and these scientists, these biologists. It's not because they've examined the evidence and it is so overwhelming that they say it's got to be true. Here's the reason. The reason is they don't want to accept God. I want you to notice this quote from Sir Arthur Keith. He says, evolution is unproved and unprovable. We believe it because the only alternative is special creation, and that is unthinkable. He said, it's not because the evidence is overwhelming to us. It's because the only other alternative is there's a God, and we just cannot accept that. Richard Lowington said, our willingness to accept scientific claims against common sense is the key to an understanding of the real struggle between science and the supernatural. We take the side of science in spite of patent absurdity. We are forced to our adherence to materialism, no matter how counterintuitive, no matter how mystifying to the uninitiated. Moreover, that materialism is absolute. Now, here's the reason. For we cannot accept a divine foot in the door. He says, even though it's counterintuitive, even though it may be patently absurd, we have to accept it because the only other option is there is a God. Was Darwin wrong? Oh, yes, he was wrong. And friends, if you could talk to Charles Darwin today and ask him, he would say, yes, I was wrong. Yes, I was wrong. Friends, the evidence is on the side of a Creator, and that Creator is the God of heaven. And that God requires today that we obey Him. He has revealed Himself to us in His Word. And today, the way we obey Him, the way we prepare for eternity, is by obedience to the gospel.